Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince.
Welcome to the 27th season of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
And we are dealing with some very, very explosive things, such as
bees.
We're going to explain how bees explode, why wasps don't explode, how delicious wasp honey is, before we then climb into a supervolcano, metaphorically.
And then we're going to discover how you might feed yourself inside the supervolcano by eating fungi.
Or ultra-processed food. We're also going to look at ancient DNA and
sharks.
Listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt. This edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 30th of June. French authorities prepare for a theatre of urban violence following days of protests sparked by the shooting dead of a teenager by police. We get the latest from Paris. The US Supreme Court has reversed decades of affirmative action in a landmark decision on university admissions. And Austrian police seize hundreds of guns as well as drugs in raids targeting a far-right biker gang. Also in this podcast,
I'm interested in who ate who in the past. Sometimes that's what ancient people ate, and sometimes that's who ate ancient people. So I was interested in figuring out who might have ate our ancestors.
We hear just how far back human cannibalism goes. And Turkmenistan has a new smart city. You'll never guess who it's named after. We start, though, in France. That is the sound of protesters in the Paris suburb of Nanterre, 2 days after a 17-year-old was shot and killed by a police officer. Reports in France say police there are preparing in the coming nights for what an internal security note seen by the news agency AFP has described as a theatre of urban violence. Now, the distrust between the French police and those living in the poorer, racially mixed suburbs of Paris has once again been laid bare by the killing of a boy known only as Nahel on Tuesday. 40,000 police, that's nearly four times the amount deployed yesterday, are being sent out to try to quell the unrest that's so far gone on for two nights. President Emmanuel Macron has condemned the shooting, but he's also said the violent response was unjustifiable. The policeman suspected of the killing has been charged and remanded in custody. Just before we recorded this podcast, I spoke to Janette Gillil in Paris.
Well, violence has broken out, not just in Paris, but in cities across France, from Lille in the north to Marseille in the south, where the tourist area of the old harbour has been evacuated after protesters who'd taken part in a march to honour the dead teenager smashed up shops and restaurants and threw fireworks at the police. And in Paris, after another march in the dead boy's honour on Thursday afternoon, in the Paris suburb where he lived and died, Nanterre, some of the protesters there also attacked police and set fire to cars, and a bank was set on fire. But fortunately, firefighters were able to bring those flames under control before the fire spread to the flats above the bank and to the inhabitants there. So a very, very tense situation in Paris. And we're also hearing reports of minor clashes in Brussels, where youths are reported to have gathered in the streets and thrown stones at police. And apparently there have been some arrests there, as there have in France too, as well as a heavy police presence in many cities. Police helicopters have been deployed. Curfews have even been introduced into several Paris suburbs. And in the wider Paris area, buses and trams have been stopped, all to try to contain the violence, much of it in the deprived, mainly immigrant suburbs.
How are the family and what are they saying?
Well, the mother has been talking about her son, saying he's her only child. He was her best friend. And what she says is she doesn't have any grievance against the police. She just wants the police officer involved in this attack to be brought to justice. He has been charged with voluntary homicide. And the prosecutor in Nanterre says that his initial investigation has led him to conclude that the conditions for the legal use of this officer's firearm were not met. But that's being disputed by the lawyer of the police officer, who said he didn't act outside the legal framework and that he's now going through an extremely difficult time. And the lawyer has said that the police officer has apologised for what happened to the family of the dead boy.
Janet Jalil in France. Now, the lawyer for Nahel's family is Yassine Bouzereau. Through a translator, James Menendez asked him how Nahel's family were holding up.
La famille de Nahel est effondrée.
The family of Nahel are devastated. They're completely in shock, and it's incredibly difficult for them to live through this.
Pour eux de vivre tout ça.
And what do they, the family, and indeed you, think about the rioting, the unrest that his death seems to have unleashed?
Nous pensons que les émeutes sont...
So we lay the responsibility for these riots at the door of the prosecutor, whose first and immediate reaction was to try to criminalise Nahel by talking about past criminal convictions.
En parlant d'antécédents judiciaires. Ce qui se passe, c'est que nous avons en France...
What's going on is that the judicial system in France is protecting police officers. All the cases of shots that were unauthorized being fired, and yet the judicial system is not leading to consequences for the police officers involved.
En refusant de condamner les policiers.
And yet my understanding was that a law, I think in 2017, allowed for shots to be fired in certain circumstances during traffic stops. Does the law now need to be revised, do you think?
Cette loi avait été votée.
So this law was designed to deal with terrorism and specifically with terrorists who may have killed someone and be trying to escape and be at risk of killing more people. But the problem is that police officers are applying this law to all sorts of situations, including simple traffic stops.
Pour des simples contrôles routiers.
So is this a story about that law and the way that the police are using it, or is it about racism indeed?
Non, c'est un problème de justice.
No, this is a problem of justice. And we have a law and judicial system that protects police officers, and it creates a culture of impunity in France. And that's the problem, and it's something that Amnesty International has pointed out several times.
Amnesty International l'a souvent répété.
How confident are you that you and the family will get justice?
Si la justice décide...
If the judicial system applies the law properly, then I'm confident that we would win. But the problem is that they almost never do when it comes to police officers.
Parce que la culture judiciaire...
Because French judicial culture has always sided with forces of law and order. And that's why, in fact, perhaps there is currently such a revolt going through France.
Une vague de révolte importante. Il y a eu plusieurs cas.
We've had several cases in France over the years where we thought things would change, and sadly that's never been the case, and the judicial system still isn't working for victims.
D'appliquer, de respecter la loi.
That's Yassine Bouzereau, a lawyer for Nahel's family. Let's go to the US now on what Donald Trump has called a great day for America. Critics, though, say it has set back the country after decades of progress in the fight for racial justice. The US Supreme Court has banned universities from taking a person's race into account when deciding on admissions. The ruling, backed by 6 of the 9 justices, will effectively overturn affirmative action policies that were introduced to combat historic discrimination against African Americans. Chief Justice John Roberts argued that selecting a candidate according to the colour of their skin was itself racist. President Biden said he strongly disagreed with the ruling.
While the court can render a decision, it cannot change what America stands for. America is an idea of hope, an opportunity, of giving everyone a fair shot, of leaving no one behind. We've never fully lived up to it, but we've never walked away from it either. We will not walk away from it now.
Well, the newsroom's Oliver Conway heard more from our North America correspondent, Jessica Parker.
What the US Supreme Court has ruled, and it's not a surprise because of the conservative leaning of the court as it is now, but they've ruled that universities can't consider a prospective student's race when they're deciding their admissions. Now, what universities would say, and were saying, this case was brought against the University of North Carolina and Harvard, is that race is just a factor amongst many factors that they might look at when considering who to admit to highly competitive universities. They won't be able to do that now. Students will still, though, be able to talk about their experiences, and that might relate to race, and there are other things that universities might be able to do, as they've done in states where this has already effectively been outlawed, like California, like outreach programs. But critics of this decision feel that it really is rolling back a decades-long positive policy, in their view, to address some inequalities deep-rooted in American society.
Yeah, because when the states that have banned affirmative action did so, there was a huge drop-off in the number of Black, Hispanic and Native American students enrolling. Have we had any reaction about what this might mean now?
Yes, I mean, as you say, so California is the state that people often talk about, which got rid of this type of affirmative action in the late 90s. And university leaders in that state have talked about for their public schools that they saw, as you say, a big drop-off. And it's been a struggle, actually, to try and address that balance. So people have raised that as a real concern. And then on the conservative side, you've had people like Nikki Haley, who's, of course, a presidential candidate or wants to be the Republicans' presidential candidate. She says this reaffirms a freedom and an opportunity, the values of America.
Jessica Parker in Washington, D.C. Now, to the UK and the contentious issue of how to deal with asylum seekers. The British government is challenging an appeal court judgment that its policy of deporting asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful, as Rwanda cannot be treated as a safe third country. The controversial plan is part of the Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's effort to deter migrants from trying to reach Britain in small boats. The Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, who once said it was her dream to see flights taking migrants to Rwanda, said the government would appeal to the Supreme Court.
This judgment is disappointing for the majority of the British people who have repeatedly voted for controlled migration, and for all those who want to see us deliver on our moral and democratic imperative to stop the boats.
But the deputy leader of the main opposition Labour Party, Angela Rayner, said somewhat mockingly, more Conservative Home Secretaries had been sent to Rwanda than asylum seekers. So what chance does the government have of getting this ruling overturned by the Supreme Court? Our UK political correspondent is Rob Watson.
I think there absolutely has to be some chance. For starters, this was a majority decision in the appeal court. The most senior judge on the panel actually agreed with the government. And I guess what the government will be hoping to do between now and whenever the Supreme Court hearing is to try and satisfy the Supreme Court on the issue that was worrying the appeal court, namely the sort of rather narrow issue of, was Rwanda a safe place to deport asylum seekers to, in the sense that you weren't worried about them not getting a proper hearing there and then themselves being sent to countries back home where they could face persecution and torture.
Now, clearly, the small boats issue is not one just facing the UK, but do critics of the Rwanda plan have any alternative suggestions?
Yes, so essentially there is an alternative. What the opposition are saying and some of the refugee charities is, look, just speed up the process of processing asylum seekers, because there's a huge backlog in the UK. There's more than 150,000 people waiting to learn whether they are legitimate refugees, whether they can stay here. And then the argument goes that if you did that, you'd have more of an ability to deport those who genuinely weren't found to have a right to be in the UK. The other plank of the platform is to work more with the French, more to work with others on a sort of global scale to sort of stop the problem at source, as it were.
Rob Watson talking to Oliver Conway. Now, a find in northern Kenya has uncovered what researchers believe is the oldest decisive evidence of humans practicing cannibalism. The new study in the journal Scientific Reports describes 9 cut marks in a shin bone fossil of a relative of Homo sapiens. It dates back 1.45 million years. Victoria Uwankunda spoke to Dr. Brianna Pobina, a paleoanthropologist at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History in the US and the author of the study.
I'm interested in general about who ate who in the past. And sometimes that's what ancient people ate, and sometimes that's who ate ancient people. So I was interested in figuring out who might have ate our ancestors.
And what did you find? This is very interesting.
So on one fossil lower leg bone of an early human, the tibia, which is your shin bone between your knee and your ankle, on the back of it in one small patch, I found a series of short marks that as soon as I saw them, first of all, I was very surprised because they weren't what I was looking for, but I've seen lots of marks like this on fossil animal bones, and I knew immediately that they were marks from stone tools left by other early humans.
And then what does that tell you about the tools and the time that these humans were there and eating each other?
Well, it tells us that at this time, so this fossil is about 1.45, almost 1.5 million years old, that early humans seem to view each other as food. We certainly know that they were eating meat from all kinds of other animals, but also occasionally from humans, from other early humans.
Was this just the way those humans were at the time? Like, what was in their makeup to just want to eat each other?
Our interpretation is that they did it because they were hungry. So we don't have any evidence at this time that there's any kind of ritual or cultural activity, any special treatment of the dead, anything like that. So we think it was probably just somebody who was quite hungry and found some other person, you know, other kind of early human that looked similar to them, maybe a little bit different, and decided that they would make a good meal.
Have you been able to find out how we evolved then from the humans eating other humans to where we are today?
Well, some humans still eat other humans today. There are some human groups that have ritual or cultural practices of cannibalism, sometimes honoring the dead, you know, sometimes in times of warfare. And so there's lots of different kind of cultural reasons why some groups of humans engage in cannibalism today. So in that way, I guess we haven't changed that much.
That was Dr. Brianna Pobina speaking to Victoria Uwankunda. Now let's go to Turkmenistan in Central Asia, where a brand new smart city has popped up. It's about 30 kilometres from the capital. It's dedicated to the country's former president, whose name has been bestowed on it. Well, the unofficial title he was known by anyway. It's called Arkadag, or Protector. He stood down last year, and in his absence, the lavish opening ceremony was performed by his son and successor. Charles Haviland has more details.
The gas-rich and highly secretive Republic of Turkmenistan built an elaborate personality cult around ex-president Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. For instance, all male civil servants would follow his example when deciding whether or not to dye their greying hair. In the new city named for the ex-leader, Arkadag, all buildings are white and all apartment blocks are 7 stories high, a number considered lucky. It's said to have been built with green technology and will admit only electric cars. Official media boast of its marble palaces, vineyards and art schools. Currently empty, Arkadag will in time house 73,000 people.
Charles Haviland. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
When I came as an immigrant to the United States, I came because I fell in lust with an American guy. And I thought I was going to get him out of my head in a week. I married him and stayed for 28 years with him.
The world-famous author Isabel Allende speaks to the BBC about life, love, and the literary inspiration from the US-Mexico border. Austrian security forces have targeted what they said were extreme right-wing outlaw motorcycle gangs in raids that saw several hundred guns and illegal drugs seized. 13 house searches were carried out in the provinces of Upper and Lower Austria. 6 people have been arrested. From Vienna, here's Bethany Bell.
The Interior Ministry said that during house searches earlier this week, the authorities seized around 35 long firearms, 25 submachine guns, 100 pistols, and more than 10,000 rounds of ammunition. They also found grenade launchers and smoke-throwing devices, along with drugs and Nazi memorabilia, including flags and daggers. The house searches this week are part of a larger investigation into extreme-right motorcycle gangs in Austria. Police say that some of the people they've arrested have close links to the right-wing extremist criminal association known as Object 21.
Now, space exploration and billionaires. Nearly 20 years after it was founded by Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic has launched its first commercial flight to the edge of space. It carried a crew of 6 astronauts who successfully landed back on Earth. It's hoped the venture will see it taking paying customers up for an estimated $450,000 a ticket. Stephanie Prentice told Oliver Conway more about the mission and how it went.
The flight took off from Spaceport America, that's in New Mexico, and there were three commercial passengers inside this craft called the VSS Unity. Now, that's attached to an aeroplane. Then the plane drops them off at a certain altitude and a rocket booster powers them towards space. Now, they reach an altitude of about 50 miles. That's what the US kind of recognises as the boundary of Earth's atmosphere and space. And at that point, we saw the passengers unbuckle themselves. They were floating around, experiencing weightlessness. And just before we came on air, Virgin Dale held a press conference. We can take a quick listen to one of those passengers, and he's talking about the moment that capsule was released.
The 20 minutes after the release was unbelievable. The acceleration, the climb, and suddenly the microgravity. I had the opportunity to look outside and the view, it was amazing, fantastic.
As we heard there, the tourists enjoyed it. There's footage of them smiling, waving Italian flags, and they conducted 13 scientific experiments during that journey. There's an obvious appetite for this sort of thing from researchers as well as general tourists. Virgin actually say they've got a backlog of 800 customers. Some of them actually paid up years ago when it was only $250,000. Bargain hunters there. And their long-term goal is to build a large enough fleet, they say, to schedule 400 of these flights a year.
Stephanie Prentice. In the 16 months since Ukraine was invaded, its western borders have become a lifeline, with supplies coming in and women and children going out in search of a safer life. People travelling from southwest Ukraine into northern Romania must cross a wooden bridge over the river Tisa, which has become a meeting point for people fleeing the fighting and others returning. But it also represents an impassable barrier for Ukrainian men who have fled the draft and cannot go back home. As Nick Thorpe reports.
It's not often in modern Europe you find yourself entering a country on foot over a bridge of wooden planks, pulling your suitcase behind you. But that's just how I witnessed people crossing from Ukraine into Romania at Sighet. The actual border is marked with a streak of red paint on the wood. Those crossing were mostly elderly people pushing their bicycles. Young men cross under the bridge, swimming the river, this couple told me, to escape the draft, while older people like themselves cross every day, legally, to sell cigarettes. You can make €2 profit on each packet you bring from Ukraine to resell in Romania. That helps supplement many humble pensions.
Hello, my name is Maria. I am volunteering in border crossing.
Maria is from Solotvino, the town on the Ukrainian side. And she works in both countries as a dance teacher for children in Ukraine and with an NGO helping refugees in Romania.
Most of the men that I grew up with or went to school with have left the country. A few are at the front, but very few. I can't really say that our community is one that is very patriotic. Most of the men have tried to find a way out of this war.
Just across the bridge on the Romanian side is the railway station in Sighet. Mitica Laver and his wife Adriana meet the 912 overnight sleeper from Bucharest here every morning and drive those wanting to return to Ukraine back over the bridge. Their first client that morning was Marina, aged 36, who works in an IT company in Kiev.
I'm going from Cluj-Napoca, where my colleagues work, and I just traveled to visit them to meet for the first time for the year.
And where are you going now? Back to Kiev?
Yes, I'm going home to my ordinary life in Kiev.
Mitica picks up a group of women and children and drives them back over the bridge in his black minibus. They have no problem crossing into Romania. The border guards know Mitica well, and he's a Romanian citizen, acting as a sort of border facilitator, helping people cross in both directions. He's a witness of many happy and heartbreaking encounters. He records some on his phone to post on his Facebook page to advertise his work. Mitica is just showing me a video. It's a young mother with a small child who's jumping up and down. She's pulling a suitcase and running towards them now is her husband, and the husband's just picking up the child, and the father is embracing his wife and child. The man was on leave from the army and forbidden to leave Ukraine. So his wife and child, now living as refugees in Romania, crossed the bridge to spend the weekend with him at a hotel in Solotvino. Meanwhile, Ukrainian men who are now in Romania, who cannot return to their country because they don't want to fight, sit in a cafe in Sighet on the Romanian side, smoking cigarettes and watching nervously for their wives to cross. Then they go to a hotel together. The bridge over the Tisza is like a valve, where some people can cross without a care in the world and others cannot.
That was Nick Thorpe on the Romania-Ukraine border. Let's hear now from one of the world's most successful authors. Isabel Allende has more than 70 million book sales to her name globally. Now aged 80, the Chilean writer has a new book out, The Wind Knows My Name, which looks at the impact of war and immigration on one child in Europe in 1938 and another in the United States in 2019. It's rooted in some of the work carried out by the charity she founded, which supports organisations on the US-Mexico border. She told Martha Carney about how that helped inspire the novel.
I got to know a case of a little girl like Anita in the book. And then I started thinking about when in history this has happened. And there are many instances. And I remembered a play that I saw a long time ago in New York called Kinder Transport. And it was the story of a little Jewish girl that is separated from her parents. And it resonated with me because as a mother, I've asked myself often, would I make that choice of sending my kid away alone to an unknown destiny? What would I do if I'm separated by force from my kid, as people are experiencing in the border even today? And I don't know, as a mother, what I would do.
So difficult, such a terrible dilemma for parents, their desperation. But you write about the experience from the child's point of view and their sadness, but also their resilience.
Yeah, they survive somehow, but with a hole in their heart. The trauma never quite goes away. They learn to deal with it.
One of the reviews talks about your book showing the human capacity for hope and decency in the midst of despair.
We always focus on the victims, the tragic situation at the border, the refugee camps, the humanitarian crisis. Nobody talks about the people who are helping. In the United States alone, there are 40,000 lawyers that work pro bono to represent the kids in court. It's mostly women who work as volunteers or as psychologists or social workers helping the kids. Those are the people that I'm interested in.
And I suppose in the sense that you yourself are able to feel that empathy because, of course, you were a political refugee early on in your own life.
But I was a very privileged refugee. I left my country after the military coup in Chile and went to Venezuela in the 70s. At the time, Venezuela was called Saudi Venezuela because it was like Saudi Arabia, so rich because of the oil. Millions of immigrants came from everywhere in the world to work and prosper in Venezuela. I was very privileged in that way, and very soon I could reunite with my husband and my children. Then when I came as an immigrant to the United States, I came because I fell in lust with an American guy, and I thought I was going to get him out of my head in a week. I married him and stayed for 28 years with him. So I was never illegal in the United States, and I never had to make a living cleaning bathrooms. I was a writer by then.
But you've decided to use your privilege, the money that you've earned as a writer, partly you've funded, as you mentioned, the Isabel Allende Foundation, in homage to your daughter, Paula, who worked as a volunteer, didn't she, in poor communities in Venezuela and Spain. She died when she was 29.
Yes. And after she died, I wrote a book called Paula, which was very successful. And I didn't want to touch any of the income that would come from that book because it didn't belong to me. It belonged to Paula. And eventually I decided to create a foundation that would continue the work that my daughter had done. And then I have sort of fed the foundation with the income of my other books. It's a very personal, face-to-face work. Therefore, I get wonderful stories, very tragic ones, and I get to meet the most resilient people.
Important for you to tell their stories and important to carry on writing. You're publishing this book at the age of 80 and you still spend many hours a day, don't you, writing?
Yeah, I forget that I am 80. People say, why don't you retire? I'm retired of everything I don't like. Now at 80, I can say no to almost everything. But I love writing. I love the process. Why would I stop doing what I love?
Isabel Allende speaking to Martha Carney. Parkinson's disease is a brain disorder that causes unintended or uncontrollable movements, like shaking, and problems with balance. So when the amateur British musician Samuel Smith was diagnosed with it in his mid-40s, he assumed that he would have to put down his guitar for good. Instead, he found that over time he was still able to play, and he had a rush of creativity, which led to a star-studded charity album. He's been talking to the BBC's John Kay about brain, body, mind and song.
I remember the neurologist looking up from his computer and saying, "You've got Parkinson's. I'm 44, I've got a kid, I've got a job." I just felt like I was being pulled down the rapids with no idea of what the end point would be. I looked down at my hand, and I just couldn't play. My arm wouldn't move. It felt in that moment like it's over.
But slowly, as his medication started to work, Samuel was able to play again.
That is a moment that I'm never going to take this for granted again. I'm going to do something with it.
Boy, have you done something with it.
I know.
His creativity went into overdrive. He was suddenly writing music like he'd never written before and recording it on his phone.
To light their flame. I want my kids to know what their dad sounded like when he was at his peak. Leaving a legacy and giving them something that they'd always be able to listen to, they'd be able to share with their kids, with their grandkids, because I don't know how long I've got.
Then Samuel started thinking bigger. He approached the award-winning producer Sam Lakeman, even though they'd never met.
I'm running.
Outshining the stars.
And to Samuel's amazement, he was invited to record some tracks at Lakeman's studio in Somerset.
I get asked all the time to make records for people, and I usually say no, but there was something about Sam's email that caught me. He explained how he had this recent diagnosis of Parkinson's, and my grandfather also had Parkinson's. Energy could draw. As soon as I spoke to him, I was in hook, line and sinker. Light up the
way. Then Samuel decided to ask for some more help. He started contacting his folk and country music heroes, asking if they would record a section of his music and send an audio file back to him over the internet.
Email, direct message, Instagram, just said, this is what I'm doing, here's what I do, here's a link.
And you didn't know any of these people?
Not one. She turns to me and she whispers,
hold me tight. Between them, the artists in Samuel's virtual backing band have won 27 Grammy Awards. We will both be seen. There's Nashville's Ron Block on banjo, guitarists Cody Kilby and Charlie T. Smith, Northern Ireland folk star Cara Dillon on backing vocals, and even Samuel's late Uncle George. Now, all mixed together on his album In the Springtime, raising money for Parkinson's UK.
John Kay with that report. And that's all from us for now. But before we go, a quick question about artificial intelligence. What's your biggest hope for its use and your greatest fear about what may go wrong? Lots to think about there, but please don't worry. As ever, please email us your answers on globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition of the Global News Podcast was mixed by Darren Garrett and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince.
Welcome to the 27th season of The Infinite Monkey Cage.
And we are dealing with some very, very explosive things, such as
bees.
We're going to explain how bees explode, why wasps don't explode, how delicious wasp honey is, before we then climb into a supervolcano, metaphorically.
And then we're going to discover how you might feed yourself inside the supervolcano by eating fungi.
Or ultra-processed food. We're also going to look at ancient DNA and
sharks.
Listen to The Infinite Monkey Cage wherever you get your podcasts.